All right, good afternoon, everyone. We're looking at an article from titled, Three Symptoms of a Dying Church.
And it happens to be from where, Nate?
Desiring God.
And you didn't pick it out.
I know.
And then we have the backup to why dying churches die. And this one's got 6 points, so we went from three to six. And then we have the backup to that one that has how many?
13.
So there's either
dying.
Yeah, we've got three symptoms.
Typical Baptist.
Six whys and 13 somethings. So let's just think.
In case we need extra content. All right. So this article is on Desiring God, and from a pastor in Scotland. I knew the patient before she died. It was 10 years ago. She was very sick at the time, but she did not want to admit it. She never got better. She slowly and painfully deteriorated, and then she died. She, of course, is a church. So writes Tom Rainier in Autopsy of a Deceased Church. One of the defining marks of a dying church is that people in it don't realize it's dying. They don't know they're on a one-way journey to the ecclesiastical morgue. There is enough about the church that makes it seem alive and worth showing up to each week. But the symptoms of death pervade. While the heart of a church is still beating, how can we take its temperature to check if it's thriving or slowly preparing to gasp its last breaths? Help from a doctor. I believe the letter of James is here to help us. Whatever kind of church fellowship we're in, if all is well, it can warn us that it all can be lost if we think we are beyond failure. If all is broken, it can be comfort and care for us if we think our collection of bruised and bewildered believers is beyond the pale. The reason James can help us so profoundly is that he sees both the symptoms and the underlying cause. He is like a physician we visit. We can convince our cough is just a cough, only to have him listen carefully to our breathing and then diagnose a much deeper malaise. James goes deep to the ultimate source of all our problems. He has a sharp scalpel, but he wields it with a gracious, loving hand because he knows exactly what medicine to prescribe. He gives us the symptoms, the disease, and the medicine for the dying church. So, three symptoms of a dying church. James lays out these three symptoms for us to help self-diagnose our health. The words we speak, the lines we draw, and ignoring good works. Number one, churches begin speaking angry words. We get the first hint of this in James 1:19. Know this, my beloved brothers. Let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to anger. The issue surfaces again in James 1:26. If anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. By chapter 3, James is giving us a full frontal assault on the damage we can do with our tongues. And the tongue is a fire, a world of unrighteousness. The tongue is set among our members, staining the whole body, setting on fire the entire course of life, and is set on fire by hell, James 3:6. James tells us these things ought not so to be, in James 3:10, but he is having to write precisely these things because these things can be so. We all know what this is like. In my home, it's usually Thursdays. I don't know what it is about this day of the week in particular, but it can be the day when our tongues do their worst. Fuses shorten, tempers fray, words sharpen, out they come. Sibling to sibling, husband to wife, parent to child, and a room is on fire. People get burnt. And uncontrolled tongues are just a symptom, not the disease.
Wow. That's the direction he went, huh?
Yep.
Thoughts?
Can be.
I mean, I don't know that that's exclusively the word symptoms of a dying church. It could also be symptoms of young Christians in a new
church.
What
do you mean by churches begin speaking angry words? Does he mean that the preacher's angry? Does he mean that members of the congregation are being angry with one another?
That's what I thought.
I just don't know if I'd agree with him or not. I don't know about the little Methodist churches and the little Baptist churches in small town USA that have silver haired. If they look back at the course of the history of their church and they think to themselves, yeah, it was when we started being ugly with each other. Well, let's go to number two.
Churches begin drawing ugly lines. In chapter 2, we discover that this church loves partiality. It has favorites. The rich over the poor, the haves over the have-nots. It is honoring certain types of people and dishonoring others. There is an in-crowd in this church and an out-crowd. There is an attraction to the people with means, wealth, and status. Such socioeconomic dividing lines might exist in your church. But even if these particular lines aren't present, we draw lines in plenty of other ways. It's what makes us feel safe in physical spaces and social groups, and what causes us to bond with some and ignore others. We draw lines between men and women, students and old people, married and single, employed and unemployed, and no doubt a myriad of other ways too. We gravitate toward those who can help us and give us much more than those who have nothing to offer us. It's why we are so unlike God when we draw lines. God loves the defenseless, the poor, and the weak, and people with nothing to contribute. It's why religion that's pure before Him visits orphans and widows, and it cares for the unrewarding of this world, James 1:27. So being biased would be point number two. So the way you speak and being biased.
So is he doing this because this is what he can find in James? For example, why churches die. This is from
Tom Rainier, which is the author of the book that
he makes reference
David
to.
Gibson, our Desiring God article, is referencing.
So
same author.
Yeah, this article is a little bit older. Six reasons why churches die. One, why churches die, they refuse to admit they are sick, very sick. I've worked with these churches whose attendance has declined by over 80%. They have no gospel witness in the community. They have not seen a person come to Christ in 2 decades, but they say they are fine. They say nothing is wrong. Seems like these two authors are... I'm just wondering, does Pastor David Gibson, is this from his years of experience? Is this because he's trying to create an article from the book of James? What is guiding him to limit himself? Number three.
Churches begin ignoring good works. The letter of James is so challenging because it is written to a church that has faith. It is a church that loves the gospel. The theology is orthodox and all the boxes are ticked. This is a church that loves preaching. They love hearing a sermon. They love the Bible. But although they love hearing the Bible, they don't do what it says. And so James blindsides us. No good works, no action, means, in fact, no living faith. You might look like you're alive, but you're dead. For as a body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead. James 2:26. Bad words, partial lines, no good deeds. If we went to see the doctor with those symptoms, and he said to us, okay, go away and speak good words, don't draw lines, and do good deeds, would that help us? Is that the cure? Where these sins come from, he says, is that the right next word? I didn't get my pages mixed up, did I?
I think that's right.
Yep. Okay. Where these sins come from? If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all of his ways. James 1:5. Lodged in these verses is a term which describes the part of the human makeup, a medical term, if you like. It's the word double-minded. Literally, the word is two-souled. This teaches that it is possible to have a two-ness to me, a two-ness corrupting my oneness. We know that living with two of you can land you in a psychiatrist's couch. As she listens to you describe yourself, eventually you are given the diagnosis of a split personality. James is saying our deepest problem, the well from which all symptoms flow, is a spiritually split personality. We are divided on the inside, and that's what leads us to cause divisions on the outside. A divided heart leads to divided actions. Just look at how doubleness inside of us takes shape outside of us. Be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourselves, James 1:22. We can be divided between hearing and doing. We love hearing, but we don't find it so easy to do. We split them off one from another. We like being in church and we love the sermon, but by Tuesday we're struggling again to do what God has told us to do. Why is that? My brothers, show no partiality as you hold the faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, James 2:1. James is probing here a very profound reason why we honor the rich over the poor. It's because one part of us loves the Lord Jesus Christ, the Lord of glory, and another part of us loves the glory of wealth, riches, and prestige. James is calling his readers not to be divided in our glory gaze. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, "Go in peace, be warmed and filled," without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? James 2:15 and 16. We divide faith and good works, thinking we can separate them and safely have one without the presence of the other. Why is that? From the same mouth comes blessing and cursing, James 3:10. Notice the dividing line splits our mouth. Our speech is not united. It's double in form and content. Thoughts? So, it really seems like this is I went through the book of James and saw some common themes. Let me write an article on this.
And the thing of it is the three symptoms of a dying church. I don't think he's saying that all three symptoms have to exist. I think he's saying if one of these exists, your church is in danger of dying. I mean, at least I think that's the attempt he's trying to make. Like, is your church characterized as being divided and you're bickering and fighting over everything? Or is your church seen as a group of cliques? A group of cliques. It's the Awana people versus the nursery people versus the Wednesday night Bible study crowd versus the choir versus... Or is it y'all have all just given up and you're just going through the motions and you're there, but you're not really doing anything at all towards the kingdom because you're so inwardly focused and just bunkered in kind of scenario. And I think it's saying, okay, these are three stereotypes, churches that we would say are in danger of losing it. So like the old-haired Southern Baptist, you know, gray-haired, silver-haired church that you were talking about, Pastor, and them looking back, they would probably be the ones that have just begun to ignore good works. They've bunkered in, they like who they are, and,
yeah.
they just roll with who they are, and they don't really get anything going anymore.
That's what our article from Tom Rainier is. One of his points is, point number six on why churches die from him, is that they desire to return to 1985, or 1972, or 1965, or 1955, that they just want to go back to the good old days on how they used to do things. And I don't know what y'all think as far as wanting to kind of continue on this article, but it kind of seems like the objective of David Gibson was to address what causes a church to die, which is kind of why I think we wanted to look at the article. But Tom Rainier's 6 points are that churches die because they refuse to admit that they are sick, which I think probably would be in the recognition of Gibson's 1 and 2. Or he also says that they're still waiting on that magic bullet pastor, that if they had the right pastor, that everything would be okay. That they fail to accept responsibility, that it's not our fault. It was the pastor that we had's fault, or all the previous pastors.
Or the culture.
Yeah. Number 4 from Tom Rainier is that they are not willing to change at all. Number 5 is that their solutions are all inwardly focused. And number 6 is that they desire to return to 1985 or whatever point in time they view was better. Those kind of seem more along the lines for reasons on why churches actually die. Because, I mean, I'm just thinking about the church I grew up in, which... if it's still going in 5 years, that'll be surprising because most of the congregation will be dying off and has slowly been dying off over the last several years. But, I mean, they have no desire to change anything. Everything's always been the way it will be. And even thinking about the ugly lines from Gibson's article, just from personal experience, that they had, my home church had decided that my brother did not have an ability to help with the sound because of a medical condition that he has. They didn't think he would be up to the task. And so in a church that has 35 people on a Sunday morning, they've told someone who's interested in serving in the sound and media booth not to go back there and touch anything. So, I mean, some of these points from the other articles I definitely see being...
I was just surprised that they didn't go to the gospel. That's what just shocked me.
What, that the gospel's not being preached?
Yes.
I mean, because I look at this, okay, and I think about... Well, one, when I hear of a dying church, my mind immediately went to the Lord builds the house. Now, I know that there's a cautionary element of saying that. We can be so reliant upon, well, God will build it if God wants it, that we do nothing. But I think that's where we would run into then the conflict with the gospel. We're not preaching the gospel. We're not promoting the gospel. We're not living out the gospel. You know, there is a lack of evangelism. There's a lack of new coming into the church. And I don't mean new as in drums and programs. I mean new as in people. You know, young people. New families. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A new generation.
Right.
You just have to, I think you have to be clear in your explanation of focusing on the gospel, because, like I said, only speaking from experience of the church I grew up in,
they're all going to say every single the gospel, right?
All of them would say they preach the gospel, and in fact, they would be remotely accurate, because every single Sunday morning sermon at 11 o'clock is going to be the exact same thing week after week.
Right, but your church back home's not dying.
Well, I guess that would be, we need to define the word dying. Is dying as they're growing spiritually dead, or they're dying as in the church is about to close its door?
No, the dying churches, from Rainer's perspective, are churches that are closing. There are more churches closing than opening in the United States.
Because my parents' church, I would see it as a dying church, as in 5-10 years, it will close its doors and cease to be Blessed Hope Baptist Church.
Really? 5 to 10 years?
Because they'll all die off.
And they're not attracting young people.
It's not attracting young people. It's not doing anything to bring in new folks. And if they are new, then they're 75, 80 years old, because that's who's already
there. All right, so there's his 3 points right there. Is that your church? Are they doing those 3 things?
See, in Gibson's article, I wouldn't say that. I would say Rainier's points are more about what it is that I see in my parents'
church. So what's
church.
Gibson's article then? Symptoms of a dying church.
I think he would define dying as it's dying in... It's not alive to the gospel. That it's not
a spiritual.
It's not spiritually alive.
He addresses them at the very end, as far as.
Let's hear it. How does he address it?
You're going to read.
Go ahead.
Sure. Feeling good today. You heal the divided heart with the gospel, with grace. What was the last time you asked someone to forgive you? When was the last time you repented out loud to God for your specific thoughts, spoken words, or named actions? That's how we measure if we are taking the medicine. And I'm guessing he's implying the medicine, the gospel. You can start now here at your computer screen with these words in front of you. God is so tender with us, so merciful, so patient. And so, I don't know, I was glancing through that when you asked if he was addressing the gospel at all.
Because that
seems like more, not so much as a church, but as an individual. People a part of the church.
Yeah, and that's what I kind of want. We'd have to define the word dying. I mean, are we talking that Joel Osteen's church is dead because there is no gospel, you know, presence?
Because
the doors are open and the budget looks great, that it's alive. So, I mean, at least with Gibson's article, I don't think he necessarily addresses that. I don't know, looking at Tom Rainier's article... I don't think he necessarily is focusing on one versus the other, but based upon what his points are, it looks more like it's our theology's right, but we're looking at things that will force us to close our doors. And the other article we had looked at some points, it's focusing more on numerical dying rather than spiritual dying.
Let's see.
And is it even worth separating the two?
No, it's not worth separating the two.
I think that this article, that seems every reference is from the book of James. It seems like, and we've probably all experienced this at some point, you know, you're in a book of the Bible and you're studying it so you can prepare it for teaching or for preaching, and then, you know, all your thoughts are around that book, and then you begin to think about issues in your life or in your church's life, and they seem to connect to what you're and because you spent so much time in it, you make a bigger connection than the objective observer is going to say. So I just quickly on my phone read the entire book of James. Just thumbed through and read the entire book of James. And the problem with this article is it's one of those deals where he's like trying to shove something into something that's not there.
Yeah.
Is everything accurate? Yes, it's all accurate. But is that really the point of the book? No, the point of the book seems to be addressed to individuals. If these individuals get all those things straight, will the church be better? Of course. But I think it's also one of those things that we kind of fall back, and I don't know where these things start, because I grew up in a Christian household all my life, and people will say things like, well, you know, the book of James is all about the local church. They'll give books like topics, and so when people go into it, I think sometimes they also go into it with presuppositions, looking for stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why do they do that? Well, because they're moody. Theological handbook said that was that way, or whatever, you know, or the Gruden or something, and so you've got the thing is told to the next guy, and the next guy tells it to the next guy, and before you know it, you know, the book of James is about the local church. Well, I just read it. It doesn't really ever go. You got one little passage that says someone comes into your assembly. Does that make the whole book about the local church? There's all kinds of other stuff in there that doesn't seem, it seems right. to be addressed to an individual.
Yeah,
right.
And was it written to a local church? Of course. But to try to make like a really profound article, I think you're kind of stretching it.
I agree. Here's what. How old is this article? 13 Deadly Sins ones. I didn't see a date.
That one was recent as well.
All right, this is 13 Deadly Sins of a Dying Church. I won't read the subparagraphs. I'm just going to give you the
August,
big points.
Yeah, August.
August. All right. And Scott Ball is the Director of Services. Lead died with TMG.
Which is the it's on the front of this one. The Malfurst Group. And he's at Church Culture. He focuses on church culture, church growth, and church revitalization.
The church lacks a process for turning guests into regular attenders.
So this is going to be a more practical article.
It is.
Yeah.
The church focuses more on internal than external issues. They get addicted to programs. The facility is neglected. Senior pastors are expected to visit everyone. The weekend services aren't, and then there's something blocking that word, probably engaging. You know, it's got those little boxes that, you know. The church has no plan for leadership succession. The community doesn't know the church is there or that they care. They can't explain their wins. The church has declining attendance. Pastor or staff turnover is high. Prayer is a formality, not a foundational. Lay leaders and the pastors don't know where the church is heading. Super practical there.
Mm-hmm.
Super practical.
Yep. Number six was...
Yep.
The services are not engaging.
The weekend services. Their weekend services. That's the buzzword, John. Mm-hmm. Weekend services.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that
can't be only on Sunday.
Right, can't. It's got to be like Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and all that. So, Jack, you've been a Christian for a very long time, been involved in churches for a long time. Someone said to you, Jack, what do you think the number one reason why churches in America are dying? The number one reason.
They lose their focus on God, on Christ. They become... they go through the motions. You're in the church, you would still hear preaching about Christ. They would still sing choir specials. They would still do everything. But it would be a shell of operation, tradition. We're gonna follow the same bulletin format that has the service order exactly the same. Everything's perfunctory. There's no there's no deviation. If deviation was to exist, everybody would die of shock. There's a lack of any kind of emphasis in the development of the children and the youth. And I don't mean that they don't have youth programs. Those youth programs are fun. They might be entertaining. They're more clubbish than they are actually developmental and discipleship. Discipleship might be a word that would be used, but nobody really understands it. Children's church would definitely exist, but it would be for entertaining and color books and handouts and basically babysitting service with a little bit of Jesus. I think, and I'm not trying to be critical or anything, I see that in churches around our nation, and it's all, and they will want to be program driven. They will want to have all of these activities and everything else, but they're not focused on how do we make a person develop and harden their Christianity to make an impact the way that Christ made an impact. There would be an avoidance of contact with the community. And you wouldn't be out there doing services, that's for sure, to the community.
So talk about the church in Ohio.
So they would be the Tom Rainier's 1985 point. That is them. They have said multiple times by they, this is coming from my mom, that it's not for lack of trying that no one comes to the church, because they've gone out and they've canvassed the neighborhood hundreds of times in the, oh man, probably 20 years the church has been on that facility. Well, more, longer than that. And so it's not for lack of trying. And so I would say one of the issues is that they're still doing the tried and true methods of 1975 to try to reach people. So that's one reason that I would say that they're not seeing any fruit from their efforts, just because I think the age of people answering their door to cold calls is gone. Even if there's somewhat of a connection that you might know the person, just I think that's gone away. I would also see, looking at Rainier's point, the not willing to change. Just there's very much the certain way we've always done things. And growing up, it was a refusal to be open to anything other than what they expressly believed. I distinctly remember, even to this day, and I've been here for almost 8 years, college for 4 years before that. So it's been a good 15 years since I was fully active in that church for a year. I know I am old. Of course, that put me at 15, but so, you know, just looking back, we had a guy that was attending that had come from a different church and knew of a men's fellowship group that he suggested our men get involved with, but it was a Southern Baptist church, and the senior pastor said, no, we're not going to do that. We're not Southern Baptists. I know the Bible translation issue is a big one for them, to the point of they would go back and edit sermon recordings if a guest speaker said anything about another translation. In fact, I know a guy that got blacklisted because back at the King James 400th anniversary, they had a good friend of the senior pastor there, a guy that was a special speaker year after year, celebrating the King James. He was there for that. He was preaching the sermons on, you know, the impact of the King James Version. Made a reference to the fact that he liked to use other translations for comparative study so that he knew what was reliable, you know, that he was looking at, you know. And I just, because I was involved in the audio department and...
They shot him right there.
Snipers in there.
The trap door next to the pulpit.
Yeah. So they, I mean, and I distinctly remember having them go back because I put together the little DVDs or CD recording set for people of that. And before they released them, they went in.
They had an explicit lyric.
Yeah, if you played it backwards, you heard it in the ESV translation. And he had the guy edit it out. because he didn't want that being purported. He encouraged me not to come work here because we weren't King James only.
You know, that just...
And that was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. That, yeah.
We were still using the King James a lot.
Yeah, but we weren't King James exclusive. And so he encouraged me not to, and I'm like, sorry, the Holy Spirit's already made it clear to me that that's where I should go. So.
Wow.
So I just see things like that, the refusal to make any type of change, when they would get someone new in, that there was, it was very cliquish, the drawing the ugly lines, it became very apparent that if you were a member of the pastor's family, because both of his, two of his three adult children were members there with their families, that there was very much preferential treatment. Things happened quickly when it was one of their family that wanted something, or reactionary if something had happened to their family. So I saw those kind of things happen, and it was just, that's the kind of stuff that I watched. I'm like, okay, all of this is just pointing to your demise. To the point that my dad has said when the current pastor retires, because he's mid-70s, that even if the pastor hands it over to his son, who's currently the assistant, associate, whatever, that he would...
Church is big enough to have two people?
No. What it is it because of the people that are there, they're financially stable enough. The buildings, the property's paid for, they don't have any debt, and you've got older, retired people, they put out quite a bit in missions. I mean, they have 60-plus missionary partners at $50 a month. Because they only have the senior pastor's salary and then part-time salary for the associate. Which is his son. But his son is a realtor full-time, so I don't see him ever actually wanting to take over the church. And they're still at the free to thrive and the extra stuff on the weekend and things like that where they're, you know, it's two or three three families that basically do everything. And now I say that, the flip side is I'm super thankful for having grown up in that church, because the reason I can be a sound guy in our auditorium is because as a 13-year-old, I was taught how to run sound because there weren't many people to do it. The reason I was able to do some remodeling in my youth building is because my dad was a deacon who also did half the maintenance. My mom was and still is the cleaning lady, so... I mean, you grew up in a small church like that, it benefits you later in life, whereas now we have staff people that take care of all that stuff, so I see the benefit to it, but at the same time, I do see things that have led to its reduction and of its eventual demise.
It's sad.
It is. Some of it's pragmatic, like the location of the building that they bought is a former church. It was a Church of the Nazarene, and it's in a residential neighborhood. You'd never know it was there, so you're getting no drive-by traffic. They've kind of made themselves a little bit of a stench in the nose of the neighborhood for blocking off their extra parking lot that they don't really use, but they don't want other people using it and tearing it up. The city of Kettering, where it sits, they actually now rent their other parking lot for regular use, but there's been a tussle back and forth between that. So there were plenty of opportunities and things if they were willing to fudge a little on, we don't have to be hard-nosed on this because it's a gray area, that I think they could have made a little bit of a better reputation for themselves. And then conversely, they're also in a rather liberal area. I mean, they're 10, 15 minutes outside of downtown Dayton. Which, for the most part, is a fairly liberal area. So, you put everything together, and it makes a perfect storm that'll take a church of what was 120, 130 when it was in its prime to now down to 30, consisting of four or five families.
Wow. Yeah. And what's sad is sometimes the other side of the story, you know, there's a church in Chattanooga that was a solid, just a good church, and now it's a huge church, but zero gospel preached, strange gospel preached, you know, healings and just bizarre stuff. And, you know, I got college friends still go there. And so it is difficult to say what a dying church is, because I would say that
that church is spiritually dead.
It's got a lot of people going to it, but yeah, spiritually dead. Yeah. It's just kind of sad. But I think part of the reality is that even though we like to think so, nothing in life ever just keeps humming along and doesn't die, doesn't cycle, doesn't... I mean, businesses, your own health, your life, your family life, the life and history of the church. I mean, just think about the tumultuous history of, you know, our church background, you know, the Baptist background and the Anabaptists and the, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, and just on and on and on. You know, life just doesn't stay the same. And we have these rose-colored glasses that we're going to build this church in the 70s and it's going to be here for 100 years or whatever. It just, it doesn't, you know, it rarely happens. So I think one of the biggest things for churches to say, take your own temperature, and Jack mentioned it, is they lose sight of, you said lose sight of God.
Christ, yeah.
Yeah, and I would say, I would be even more specific, they lose sight of the suffering Christ. Because, you know, Christ told us that, you know, you're going to suffer for me, and that the numbers aren't going to be, you know, it's not a numbers game. You're not winning when you're big. You're losing in Christ's definition of it. And I don't know what that means in our century, but he said it.
So the fact of the matter is that in our society today, and it's true, John, if I want my family's values to continue, I have to take the time to invest them and train them into my child. In the same aspect, in the spirituality or the numbers, whichever definition you want to look at, like Brian's saying, how are we going to define it, no matter which way we want to go with it? Is it the impending doors being closed, or is it, can it be a big church with a spiritual dead nature to it? The fact of the matter is that if the people don't have an awareness that the next generation is absolutely important to the livelihood and the vitality of what they value, and if they don't value Christ first, that's our first problem. But if they value Christ first and everything else, then there has to be a propagation of that when you're living your life. And what I mean by that is, it's not going to the 1985 Romans Road. It's not going to the 1990s faith or 2000, early 2000s faith program. It's not these program driven. Let me tell you what it is. It's the patient transport guy who came into my room on Sunday morning, got my bed, got me on the gurney, and is taking me to the OR, and I hear him praying. And I looked at him, I said, "Are you praying?" And he goes, "Yes, I'm praying for you." And I was like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You're fixing to have surgery, man. And my God's a healer. Jesus Christ died on the cross that we could be healed, and he's a great physician, and I know that's supposed to be for your spiritual sins and everything else, but it doesn't mean he can't heal you physically, too, through the hands of our doctors that you're about to be turned over to." I said, "Do you go to church?" He's like, "Yeah. Actually, I'm between churches." I was like, "Well, have you checked out Berean?" And we had a massive conversation down the hallway.
As he was shoving needles in your arms, and here, try this.
Well, no, he's just the patient transport guy.
Yeah.
And I probably had 5 or 6 different conversations with people who are needing church, down to the guy who come into my room Monday morning, and he's in there, and he's the guy taking out the trash and doing the cleanup in the room and everything else, and he just looks like, you know, he comes in, he's doing the customer thing. "Hey, how are you doing, sir? Are you doing okay?" "Yeah, I'm doing okay. How are you doing?" And he looks at me and he goes, "Not too good." And I said, "Well, what's wrong?" He's like, "Relationship problems, man, relationship problems." I'm like, "Well, you got a moment? We'll talk. I'm bored. Got nobody in here with me," you know, kind of thing. But how many people live with that awareness? "Pastor, I've been out with you in public and everything else, and you know, we drive someplace or we go to a restaurant or whatever, and you bring God into it. It's not always blatantly out in your face, but But God is there. It comes up in conversations. I've seen people. You can tell you've developed relationships with the places that you go to on a regular basis. You can tell that you minister to people who are working on your mowers and things of that nature. But how many of our people believe that serving God has to be done in the walls of this building?
Mm-hmm. Which is one of the things that they talk about, internal versus external.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the keys. But I think it's because they lose perspective.
All right, it's 3 o'clock. We were all over the map with 13, 6, and 3, and we analyzed one of the articles, and I don't think that we have any immediate solutions.
No.
Things that come to my mind is failure to living for Christ, failure to preach the gospel, failure to exegete scripture, failure to take worship seriously. Those are the things that come to my mind off the top of my head as to things that contribute to a dying church. The church died up in Michigan that just broke my heart. It was 50 years old and it was a solid church and it died. You know, we want to set the conditions that Brian doesn't have to be one of those churches. And so that's why we're having this conversation. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.